When was Jesus born? When did he die and rise from the grave? And what does the timing of these events have to do with Christian theology and practice for the last 2,000 years? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December is titled, When Was Jesus Really Born? It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or you can check out When Was Jesus Really Born at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month, When Was Jesus Really Born? I think we know the story. Sometimes we've heard it so many times, it's just so familiar. We don't listen anymore. What is the real Christmas story? Who are the real cast of characters in that famous nativity? Merry Christmas. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be talking with Dr. Paul Meyer about the first Christmas. And then we're going to be studying the Christmas hymn, Hark the Herald Angels Sing, with Dr. Arthur Just of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Paul Meyer is a regular guest, professor emeritus of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, author of several books, including In the Fullness of Time, a historian looks at Christmas, Easter, and the early church, and his latest novel titled The Constantine Codex. Dr. Meyer, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good to be back with you, Todd.
Give us a snapshot, if you would, of the world, in particular first century Palestine during Roman rule, into which Jesus Christ was born.
Well, the Jewish people from about 160 B.C. on had achieved their independence from the overpowering Assyrian forces to the north. And so this was their last independence, you might say, really until the modern era. And then in 63 B.C., the Romans took over. General Pompey conquered Jerusalem. And ever since that time, they were under either an actual Roman governor, administrator, or a client king who served in the place of the Roman governor, and that would be Herod the Great. Herod himself, of course, has a very checkered background. He was the son of Antipater, who was a friend of the Romans and helped them when they were conquering Egypt, and so this kind of established the Herodian dynasty on the throne there as Roman client kings, meaning that they were simply Roman governors with the title of king, however, and so they could have some independence, you might say, but they were the Palestinians, and at that point, I'm not sure they should be called that. The Judeans were under Roman control. This meant that, yes, they were taxed, but not overpoweringly so. You know, I think our biblical novels sometimes and movies exaggerate that. I've often said I would rather be a Jew paying the provincial Roman tax than American income tax, for example. So it's all somewhat relative. There was peace in the land, yes, because at this point the Romans had rolled out the welcome blanket of peace across the whole Mediterranean world, and so this was a time of peace and prosperity for the empire in general and Judea in particular.
Much is made of the messianic expectations of Jews at this time. How would you describe that, Dr. Meyer?
Well, there had always been these messianic predictions in the Old Testament of God's great deliverer. It was understood more in a political sense by the people. They thought that when the Messiah had come, he would liberate the land from all control by the Romans or anyone else. You have to remember that for any foreign governor to be in charge in Palestine was something of a heresy because of the Deuteronomy passage that says, you shall not place over you one who is not your brother. And so any Gentile who was in charge at the time, be he Herod or later on in the New Testament, Pontius Pilate or whatever, this was heretical as far as the Jews were concerned. And for that reason, they're looking for a political Messiah who will overthrow the Romans. The Messiah came all right, but it turns out that he was a spiritual Messiah, not a political one, as we well know.
Luke starts his account proper of Jesus' birth with Caesar's census of the Roman world. It's become so much embedded in our narrative of the thing, we kind of just read right past it. What was the Roman emperor up to in this census?
Well, I think it's a very interesting way that Luke begins the nativity account. You know, he doesn't begin it with any biblical figure we're familiar with, no Mary or Joseph or baby Jesus or shepherds or magi. He begins with Caesar Augustus, who otherwise I think is a rather un-Christmassy figure. Have you ever received a Christmas card with a marble bust of Augustus on the front? I don't think it would fly. Or slogan inside Caesar's greetings, you know, or whatever. But it's Luke's way of authenticating the episode. He's saying this took place at a definite time and place that you can check up on. You people who were up in your Roman politics, everybody knew about the great Augustus. He was probably the finest emperor the Romans ever had. Too bad it was right at the beginning only. But he established the Pax Augusta, it was called, the peace of Augustus across the empire. And he was very interested, of course, in how many subjects he had for military purposes, for fiscal purposes, you know, collecting the taxes and this kind of thing. And so he himself was so pleased with the censuses that he personally took that when he died, he had inscribed on two marble columns, I should say two bronze columns, in front of his mausoleum, a list of the 36 items for which he was most proud, kind of a political testament. And point number 8, I took a census of the empire 3 times. And again, the census that reached far off Judea was probably in response to that middle census, which he took about 8 B.C., and it would then may have been implemented in Judea about 2 or 3 years later, because Jesus himself, as you know, was not born in the year 1 or 0. It was probably 5 B.C. So it was probably 2 or 3 years later that the census reached the Holy Land, we call it, and it was implemented then by Herod.
So that brings up the question of the date. We have some markers. You just mentioned one of them. How close can we come to, if we can at all, to dating the actual birth of Christ?
We had a conference, Todd, at the University of Mississippi some years ago, a nativity chronology conference, in which we tried to get as close as we could to dating the nativity itself. And about the closest we could actually get is sometime between June and December of 5 B.C. I know it's not as nearly as precise as we would like, but that's about the best we can do in terms of all the parameters that come into the nativity account. There's a big movement recently, of course, to try to get Jesus born closer to the dates when he should. That is, you know, 1 B.C. or 1 A.D. or something like that. There's a discussion once again arising over the time of the death of Herod the Great. The canonical, usual date is around the 1st of April, 4 B.C. And this, of course, alerted the church some years ago as to how the Magi episode could ever have taken place if Herod had been dead 4 years already in the grave. And so we knew something was wrong with the calendar. And so Jesus was at that point shifted back to 4 or 5 B.C. Recently, however, there has been some attempt to get Herod dying more properly around 1 B.C., but I don't think it's successful myself.
So let's talk a bit about the persons of Mary and Joseph. Joseph is simply referred to as a righteous man, and then Mary, of course, as a virgin. She's just described in those terms, and both of them hailing from Nazareth. Talk about these two, if you would.
It's interesting to figure out why Joseph would have been up in Nazareth in the first place. He was probably from Bethlehem. Some years ago at the University of Chicago, Shirley Jackson Case, a professor of New Testament, had an interesting idea, and that is that Joseph came north to Nazareth because he was involved in the reconstruction of Sepphoris. S-E-P-P-H-O-R-I-S. The name does not show up in the New Testament, but it's a very famous early capital of Galilee, which resisted the Roman census that we were talking about. And to make an object lesson of the city, the Romans did tear the city apart. And so Herod Antipas, that was the most successful son of Herod the Great, rebuilt the city in about a 12-year period, which is about the average for Herodian city building proclivities. And in order to build this thing that fast, he would have to have construction help from all over the Holy Land. And for that reason, Professor Case, I think quite justifiably suggests that Joseph, who was more than just a carpenter, he was it could be anybody in the construction trades. The term tecton means wood carpenter or a bricklayer or a stone cutter, hod carrier, and so forth. Anybody in the construction trades would be a tecton. And Joseph's talents then would be needed in the rebuilding of Sepphoris. And he may then have parked his family in a lovely little suburb of Sepphoris called Nazareth. Today, issues on the other foot. Sepphoris is an archaeological ruin, and Nazareth's a big city. But in those days, it was just the opposite. So Joseph himself, then, a righteous man indeed. He's kind of the unsung hero of the Christmas story, I think. You know, he's the shadow, spotlight, I should say, is on Mary and on the baby. And he's the one, however, who has to have enormous faith when he learns the reason for his betrothed pregnancy. Imagine how that would affect anybody else with news like that today. But he faithfully believes that this is something special, and he then credits the Lord with knowing what he's doing, and indeed follows through very obediently, does exactly the right thing as far as Mary's concerned, shields her from anybody but the nice intruders, the shepherds, and later on the Magi, and then certainly has to be on guard in the flight to Egypt and the trip back to Nazareth. He's the great protector, the guardian on a human level.
Well, that's Joseph. When we come back from the break, we'll talk about Mary. She's one of the big characters there in the true Christmas story. Dr. Paul Meyer is our guest. We're talking about the first Christmas. He's Professor Emeritus of Ancient History at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. On this Christmas day, he is our guest, and we're talking about the real story of Christmas. We'll be right back. Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. St. Mark Lutheran, Edmond, Oklahoma. Emmanuel Lutheran, Manchester, New Hampshire. University Lutheran Chapel, Minneapolis, Minnesota. Prince of Peace Lutheran, Freedom, Pennsylvania. Holy Cross Lutheran, O'Fallon, Missouri. St. Paul Lutheran, Indianapolis, Indiana. Christ Lutheran, Rochester, Minnesota. Holy Cross Lutheran, Carlisle, Iowa. St. Peter's Lutheran, Indianapolis, Indiana, and Grace Lutheran, Wellsville, Missouri. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Steadfast Lutherans, people who believe that traditional Lutheran preaching, liturgy, and hymnody continue to deliver Christ crucified for sinners today. The Reformation attempted to return the church's focus on what we do for God back to a focus on what God does for us, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures. Some things never change. The gospel is still under attack from inside and outside the church. To see how Lutheran doctrine and practice preserve the gospel, visit steadfastlutherans.org.
Those beautiful notes were just the beginning of We Praise You and Acknowledge You, O God, Concordia Publishing House's debut CD collection from Pastor Stephen Starkey, one of the most significant Lutheran hymn writers of our time. For a limited time, save 10% when you use promotional code URA. Simply visit cph.org today. Lutheran thought, Lutheran substance, Lutheran music, brought to you by Concordia Publishing House.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. on this Christmas Day. Dr. Paul Meyer is our guest. We're talking about the first Christmas. Dr. Meyer, before the break, you were telling us about Joseph. That brings us to Mary. What should we know about her?
We have here, the most remarkable woman in all of history, simply because of the incredible mission given her by God to bear the great Messiah himself. It's just almost too overpowering for her to comprehend, or anyone else, even to the present day. The magnificence of the incarnation itself. She was a Galilean girl. Early church tradition said she came from Sepphoris, which is only 3.5 miles northwest of Nazareth. And supposedly she met Joseph in the streets of Sepphoris there somewhere. And she, was obedient to the heavenly vision. She, in her pregnancy, visits Elizabeth, her cousin in Judea. That's so normal a thing to do. And then goes back to Judea for the birth itself, as you well know. She, of course, faithfully rears Jesus later on. Doesn't always know where Jesus is at all times. She herself is not gifted with a divine knowledge, else the 12-year-old Jesus episode could never have taken place, as you well know. They had no trouble finding Jesus if she had divine omniscience. And in between the episode of the 12-year-old Jesus in the temple and the beginning of Jesus' public ministry, Joseph certainly must have died. And Mary, of course, continues holding the family together, and she is very much present in Jesus' ministry, as you well know, and she's at the cross and later on celebrating the resurrection.
One of the things that might seem just a bit incredible of the nativity story is the fact that they would travel. It makes it sound like they kind of pick up to travel in response to the census order back to Bethlehem from Nazareth while she is about to have a baby. I don't know of anybody, much less in the ancient world, that would take a very pregnant, expecting woman on even that journey from Nazareth to Bethlehem, knowing that the baby's about to come. How do you sort that one out?
Yeah, it's a good critique made again by some of those who really have questions about the nativity account. Well, I think there's every reason that Mary should have made the trip with him. First of all, would she, by law, have had to accompany Joseph to Bethlehem for the census? The answer is no. We have a census document here in Michigan, as a matter of fact. Every Advent season, the University of Michigan brings out a famous census document that they have, which was signed in neighboring Egypt just about 100 years after the Nativity itself. And the neat thing about that document is not a copy of a copy of a copy of like everything else we have from the ancient world. This is the original parchment, papyrus, in which, written in Greek, is a census document from a fellow who is signing himself for the census and his wife and his kids. That's exactly the kind of thing Joseph would have had to have signed in Bethlehem, and Mary would not have had to have been along. So why did she make the trip? Two reasons. One, you were taught in Sunday school, of course, and that is that she was the faithful believer in the Messiah and all the messianic prophecies. And don't forget that Micah tells us that it's going to be in Bethlehem where the Messiah is going to be born. And so, pious believer that she is, she wants to fulfill Old Testament prophecy. It's got to be in Bethlehem. That's the one we learned in Sunday school. The one we didn't learn is, and I think it's perfectly understandable, and I think it's a very beautiful addendum to the nativity account, there's a hurry-up baby coming along. And people in those days could count to 9 in their fingers anyway, as well as today. And so how are you ever going to explain a baby coming too soon to the nosy neighbors up in Bethlehem? Best to go with Joseph, have the baby away from home, and then come back weeks later with indeterminate weeks on your arms. So it's a beautiful, understandable way that not only is Old Testament prophecy fulfilled, but also we don't have to have Mary with theological explanations to the neighbors in Nazareth as to what this baby really is.
So she was simply going away to have the baby.
Right. Happens today yet.
So bring us to, if you would, Bethlehem. And it's often, as we all well know, depicted as kind of a open-ended shed, animals kind of lounging about in there, lots of hay for the baby to lay on, things like that. How would you gently correct our picture of the birthplace?
Nice way to put it. Actually, it was not any kind of a shed or an above-the-ground barn or stable that we're used to in terms of the olive wood creches that we put under our Christmas trees today. One of the earliest of the church fathers, a great defender of the faith, Justin Martyr, who taught in Rome later on, he was born in Samaria, as a matter of fact, which is, of course, not just north of Judea. And so he's, in a sense, Jesus' neighbor spatially. And he tells us that Jesus was born in a cave or grotto or cavern in Bethlehem that was used as a stable. And indeed, the Bethlehem escarpment to the present day yet is kind of honeycombed with these grottos or caverns. In fact, there's one under the high altar of the Church of the Nativity at Bethlehem, and that could be the very one. Who knows? In any case, the fact of the matter is that if nature has provided this beautiful shelter, why not use it? And so it was for this reason that it was probably a grotto behind the caravansary or inn or something at Bethlehem at the time that the Nativity took place. Ken Bailey, of course, a theologian who's lived over in the Holy Land many years, has an alternate version. Luke says that there was no room for them in the inn. Well, the word for inn is kataluma, and that's exactly the same Greek word used for the upper room. So there was no room for them in the upper room in the residence where they were staying, probably with fellow cousins from the House of David. But there was room in the garage in those days, which instead of having a Ford car, there would be a donkey. This would be kind of the stable under the house. It's an interesting alternative. I will follow Justin Martyr's version, however, preferably.
Then that brings us to the other cast of characters, if you will, to the humble shepherds. And Luke simply notes that there were shepherds out in the field keeping watch over their flocks by night. Sounds like a pretty ordinary practice. We have this picture of kind of a well-moonlit hillside, lots of sheep, lots of shepherds, a perfect stage for our version of the angel's announcement. Who would we be talking about in terms of first century Palestinian shepherds?
Well, the idea that shepherds would be out in the field has given, you know, some scholars an apparent clue as to the date of the Nativity. The usual assumption among many scholars is that, well, the shepherds would not be out in the fields at night when the sheep were safely in the sheepfolds and in the barns or whatever else. They would be out in the fields only during lambing time is the claim, and so many have tried to date the Nativity in March instead. That's somewhat questionable, however, because the sheep in the Bethlehem area had a milder climate to enjoy than up in Galilee, for example, where they were indeed in barns of some kind in January and February. In Judea, they're out in the range all year long. I learned this from some shepherds, indeed, from Bethlehem. And the sheep in Bethlehem were usually destined for temple sacrifice at Jerusalem. The temple was only, you know, 4 or 5 miles north of there, northeast. And for that reason, they could not be polluted by being kept inside a stable. So that particular clue does vanish in terms of when the Nativity could have happened. But shepherding itself was, of course, a time-honored occupation only for the last 1,000 years around the Bethlehem area. King David, of course, was born in Bethlehem around 1000 B.C., and now his greater offspring 1,000 years later at the Nativity. And to this day, you still see shepherds out in the fields. In fact, there's an area around Bethlehem called Shepherd's Fields to the present day yet, and they're still out there all year long. Some of the shepherds are watching their flocks, so some things never change.
We're talking about the first Christmas. Dr. Paul Meyer is our guest. He's Professor Emeritus of Ancient History at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo and author of several books, including In the Fullness of Time, an historian looks at Christmas, Easter, and the early church. You can read an excerpt of that book, by the way, at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. When we come back, the next in the cast of characters may not even belong on the stage when it comes to the first Christmas, and that is the Magi. Were they kings? Were they wise men? And where would Dr. Meyer place the Magi, if not inside the nativity scene on Christmas night? And more importantly, why? We'll talk about that on the other side of the break. In the second hour of the program on this Christmas day, we're going to be studying the hymn Hark the Herald Angels Sing with Dr. Arthur Just. It's a great hymn that talks about the incarnation in beautiful poetry. Mild he lays his glory by, born that man no more may die, born to raise the sons of earth, born to bring us second birth. It's a hymn that Christians ought to be singing because it brings the fullness of Christmas into our Christmas celebration. We'll be talking about it with Dr. Arthur Just in Hour 2 of Issues, Etc. on this Christmas Day. Stay tuned. The Wise Men are next.
Christological.
My friends, Jesus comes only for sinners.
Historical.
I believe in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and in Jesus Christ, his only Son, our Lord, who was conceived by...
Sacramental.
Take and eat. This is the true body of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, given unto death for your sins.
To find a Christological, historical, and sacramental church near you, go to issuesetc.org and click Find a Church.
Would you like to learn about the Reformation theology you hear on Issues, Etc.? We'll send you a pamphlet of Luther's Small Catechism for free. It contains the biblical teachings on the Ten Commandments, the Apostles' Creed, the Lord's Prayer, baptism, the Lord's Supper, and confession and absolution. Order your free copy of Luther's Small Catechism today. Just send your name and mailing address to talkback at issuesetc.org.
It was the day after Christmas in 1538 when family and friends who were gathered around Luther's table heard him say, "There is no finer gift that a parent can give to a child than an education in the liberal arts." For over 100 years, St. Paul's Lutheran School in Brookfield, Illinois, has been emphasizing the six chief parts and the seven liberal arts, providing classical education in the Lutheran tradition. Visit our website at spbrookfield.org or call 708-485-0650.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
We now have seven Spanish language transcripts of Issues, Etc. that you can download for free.
Ahora tenemos siete transcripciones en español de Issues, Etc. que se puede descargar gratis.
These broadcast transcripts cover the six chief parts of Luther's Small Catechism and include a teaching on why do bad things happen.
Estas transcripciones cubren las seis partes principales del Catecismo Pequeño de Lutero e incluyen una enseñanza que se llama... ¿Por qué pasan las malas cosas?
Guests include Matt Harrison, Peter Bender, and Carl Fickenscher.
Los invitados incluyen Matt Harrison, Peter Bender, y Carl Fickenscher.
You can download and print these Spanish transcripts for free. Just go to issuesetc.org and click Publications.
Se puede descargar e imprimir estas transcripciones en español gratis. Solo vaya a issuesetc.org y haz clic en publicaciones.
As promised, yesterday, We started playing the music of the Christmas season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. We wait until Christmas has dawned, Christmas Eve yesterday, and then through the next 12 days of Christmas, we will be playing Christmas music, sacred Christmas music, the music of the church, because Lutheran Public Radio follows the course of the church year, and it's the very best of sacred music for the world, absolutely free, 24/7 at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Now, I know you have some extra time, perhaps, in the next couple days, in this following week. Many of you are on vacation. This is a great time, if you've never listened before, to tune in at LutheranPublicRadio.org anytime, 24/7, and listen to sacred music, Christmas music, for the world. Dr. Meyer is Professor Emeritus of Ancient History at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, and he's authored several books, including In the Fullness of Time. He's also got a new novel in his Skeleton series called The Constantine Codex. Dr. Meyer, tell us about The Constantine Codex.
Well, it's the third in a Skeleton trilogy, as you well know. I usually deal mostly in fact, Todd, as you, being a historian, but sometimes it's just a lot of fun to let the imagination romp away, and that's the reason for the Skeleton trilogy. The first was A Skeleton in God's Closet, which was the number one national bestseller in religious fiction when it first appeared in 1994, and then More Than a Skeleton followed a couple, 3 years later, and then The Constantine Codex is the third in that trilogy. We got away from the name Skeleton because it's kind of macabre, and the whole idea is a play on what actually happened. Now, the Emperor Constantine was the first Christian emperor, as we all know, but he commissioned Eusebius of Caesarea, the great church historian, to have 50 elegantly lettered copies of Holy Scripture prepared on magnificent parchment for use in the early church. Around 326, 327 A.D., this order went out, and so Eusebius did just that. And this was one of the first examples in the world of the book format. That is, no longer scrolls, but cut the scrolls down to page size, glue the edges of those pages or sew them into what's known as a codex. And the codex is simply the earliest form of the book. So, again, the Christian faith has a very important role in the origin of the book industry, as a matter of fact. The Bible, Biblos, was named for one of the ports in Lebanon where, indeed, they imported these books. In any case, so Constantine did this, and Eusebius performed this for his emperor, and not one of those codices, that's a plural of codex, has ever been found until my novel. And when it is found, of course, it startles the world because there are 67 books, not 66, in this version of Scripture. What might that 67th book be like? And then the church has got to decide on the basis of the evidence whether it belongs in the canon or not, which is a lot of fun.
Folks, you can purchase the Constantine Codex at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Meyer, we talked about the shepherds. Usually in the nativity scene, we, for convenience sake, will place three kings or king-like looking figures with their gifts on display. Where would you place them historically, these magi?
Yeah, very important. By the way, first of all, let's place them temporally, shall we, chronologically? Because so many people have the idea that the magi arrived shortly after the shepherds, and, you know, please move aside, here comes Melchior or Gaspar or somebody like that, and our nativity crush scenes, they have them, don't they? You know, kneeling next to the ox and the ass and the shepherds. You have the magi, the royal kings, and so forth. This is not going to work, even though it's a popular interpretation. As a matter of fact, I just reviewed a script for the History Channel in which, yep, they made the same mistake. You have the magi visiting the same night. And you remember the movie a couple years ago, The Story of the Nativity? Which Hollywood finally did a pretty accurate job, except once again they had the magi visiting the same night. No, that's impossible. Why do I say that? Because Matthew's version, and thank God, by the way, he's independent. He doesn't copy from Luke. Luke doesn't copy from Matthew. This is very important. Has the magi arriving when the Holy Family are now living in a house. no longer a grotto or cave or cavern. And indeed, don't forget what happens in the Nativity account according to Matthew. Jesus is circumcised on the eighth day, and then he's presented at the temple in Jerusalem on day 40 after his birth. Okay, there is no way that Mary and Joseph would ever have brought baby Jesus to Bethlehem to present him at the temple 40 days after he was born if there's an all-points bulletin out for babies from Bethlehem. Therefore, unquestionably, the Magi could not have arrived in Bethlehem until day 41. That's the terminus quo, you might say, the ad quem. The other end of it would be, let's not keep Jesus there, however, for 2 years. This is a big mistake made by quite a few scholars. As a matter of fact, in the beautiful edition the Concordia Publishing House brought out called The Very First Christmas for Kids, the artist did make a mistake on that. He has Jesus looking like a 2 or 3 year old kid waving at the Magi. That's too long. And so somewhere in between is certainly closer. And the chronology will not allow much more than about 40 or 50 days after the birth for the Magi to show up in Bethlehem, because it would screw up the chronology of the life of Christ later on too much if it were a long sojourn there. And besides which, is it cheaper to live at home or on the road? Are you kidding? You know, there's no way the Holy Family could have afforded the resources for staying that long in Bethlehem, like 2 years. No, the two-year thing comes from when the star first appeared, according to the Magi. And I'm sure it could have been something like this. The Magi might have said, well, we saw the star 6 months ago. And so Herod said, okay, let's see, I'll kill all the babies. Let's make it a year for it. No, let's make it 2 years to make sure we get all the babies. Could have been something like that. And so, again, that does not really help us in terms of dating the Nativity. But we got to keep clear that the visit of the Magi could not have come until about 6 or 7 weeks after the Nativity. The Magi, who are they?
Yeah,
well, we know that they are a caste of university people. They're not kings. They're not Oriental monarchs. They are walking universities in the absence of universities themselves, both in Mesopotamia and Persia. They were gifted in law, medicine, theology, the professions, geography, history, certainly religious history was very big in their scale of abilities. And so we don't know their number. We know there were more than two. That's all we can say, or two or more. And they do come from the East. They are a well-known caste of university people among both the Mesopotamians and the Persians. And so they're very well known from antiquity. We don't know the actual number or names of the Magi who visited. The traditional names of Melchior, Gaspar, Balthazar, that's only tradition. And whether they had red, white, black, and yellow skin, that's also all traditional.
And this is one of the things that people often question, and it's not so much with the chronology of Herod's edict to slaughter the innocents, but just the edict itself seems brutal, especially by Roman standards, if he's a kind of a vassal governor for that. What kind of a character are we dealing with in the Herod of the slaughter of the innocents, with about a minute or so before our next break?
Well, don't we have an interesting recapitulation of that, you know, in 2012? In terms of right in the Nativity time of the year, we have Newtown, Connecticut. Well, what a terrible, terrible parallel, showing indeed that atrocities can happen even in the holiest of times. And how very, very sad that is in terms of Nativity, in terms of what we're enjoying or experiencing, I should say, right now in terms of an otherwise happy Christmas season. Herod the Great, oh yeah, we have his number very well recorded for us in Josephus, of course, my favorite biblical source, quasi-biblical source, I should say. We have more solid information from primary sources on Herod the Great than anyone else in history in the first 2,000 years A.D. from the ancient world. Do you realize that? He's the number one in terms of We more than Jesus, more than St. Paul, more than Caesar Augustus, more than Octavian Augustus, more than any of the greats from the Alexander the Great. We have more information on Herod the Great, which I'll be delighted to get into after the break. But yes, it is easily possible that he could have done that. We'll try to explain why that happened. Even though Josephus does not mention the slaughter of the innocents, it is historical, and we can demonstrate that.
Well, every story has its villain, and the story of Jesus' birth, the real story of the first Christmas, has a doozy of a villain, but he's not just a storybook villain. He is, in fact, a real man of history, Herod the Great. Now, he's called Herod the Great for a reason, but when we meet him in Matthew's account of Jesus' birth, he is not great, at least not great in the sense that we would want any king of ours to be great. He is the one who is ultimately responsible for ordering the slaughtering of the innocents, that handful of children in Bethlehem. And why? Because he believes there's a pretender to his throne that has been born, and he is determined to wipe him out. Now, as you'll see on the other side of the break, Herod the Great, the man that Dr. Paul Meyer calls the monster of the Christmas story, is a track record of wiping out kids. We'll be right back. Dr. Paul Meyer is our guest. We're talking about the first Christmas.
Are you concerned about weight gain during the holidays? Work out this winter at Arch Fitness of Cottage Hills, Illinois. Arch Fitness offers adult boot camps on weekday evenings and on weekday and Saturday mornings. For more information, check out the Facebook fan page for Arch Fitness or call Kevin Reisick at 618-670-6952. Arch Fitness is located at 127 West MacArthur Drive in Cottage Hills, Illinois. Win the war against winter weight. Arch Fitness of Cottage Hills, Illinois.
Does your church need a full-time or backup organist? The Virtual Organist Service from Church Music Solutions is genuine organ leadership using your instrument with your specific selections when you need it. You can try it out for free with our demo unit, which allows you and your members to hear and see the virtual organist without obligation and without a sales pitch. For more details, go to churchmusicsolutions.com.
Education and edification. You're listening to Issues Etc.
What happens when you take solid doctrine and solid curriculum and combine them with ancient scholars and modern technology? You get Wittenberg Academy, the very first completely online classical Lutheran high school. We are unabashedly Lutheran and offer families a rigorous standard of academic excellence. Students can pick and choose classes, or they can utilize our entire curriculum for their high school education. Visit our website, wittenbergacademy.org, to find out more.
Listen to the best of the church's Christmas music during the entire Christmas season at lutheranpublicradio.org. During the 12 days of Christmas, Lutheran Public Radio, lutheranpublicradio.org.
You know you want to be there. A pile of pastors, a mountain of musicians, a boatload of laity, all passionate about worship, gathered together on the beautiful campus of Concordia University, Nebraska, this coming July, the 28th through the 31st. Comfort, comfort ye my people, preaching, praying, and singing the comfort of Christ to the troubled conscience and the broken heart. John Kleinick, Paul Solek, Betsy Werner, Brian Wolfmiller, Robin Lever, and the Stash himself, President Matthew Harrison. Oh yeah, and two other guys named Wilkin and Whedon, along with a whole pile of your favorite Issues Etc. guests. Did I mention that the registration cost starts at just $175, or that full-time students, including seminarians and deaconess students, pay just $25 registration? Yeah, seriously. I told you, you want to be there. For more information, click the link. Comfort, comfort on the Issues Etc. homepage, issuesetc.org.
Well, Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the first Christmas on this Christmas Day with Dr. Paul Meyer. Dr. Meyer, we come to the man that you call the monster of the Christmas story, Herod the Great. Was he, in fact, as bad as the Bible and, you mentioned before, Josephus, make him out to be?
Not the younger Herod the Great. The younger Herod had, I think, every reason to have that wonderful epithet attached to his name, the Great, because he was great in so many ways. He kept the peace between Rome and Judea. He guaranteed the kingdom. He drove out the invaders. He was a master builder, not only building seven great fortresses across the land, but also the great renewed temple in Jerusalem. Let's not forget that here's the builder. He's another Solomon in that respect. And he facelifted the city. He built a port up at Caesarea where there was no port by sinking ship hulls and making a great breakwater there, and the superstructure built on the ship, buried ship hulls, submerged ship hulls. He was an amazing, amazing figure, no question about it. He enjoyed the friendship of both Julius Caesar and Augustus himself. Mark Antony, you name them, all the great Romans knew him. And so he was very, very successful. Problem was, he married too often and concurrently. He had 10 different queens, and each of the queens provided offspring, princes, royal princes. All of the fellas in the group wanted to be number one, and there can only be number one. And so the household was riven by conflicting ambitions all the time, and their brothers plotting against one another regularly. If there weren't two or three major plots afoot in that household before they had orange juice in the morning, something was wrong. And so Herod, and there were plots against the throne of good old dad. So Herod put to death three of his own sons on suspicion of treason. He executed his favorite wife, the Maccabean princess Mariamne. He killed her mother, his mother-in-law, one of his many mothers-in-law, I should say. He invited the high priest down to Jericho for a swim. They played a very rough game of water polo. They drowned him. He killed several uncles, a couple cousins. You might say he was a real family man in that respect. So could he have killed a dozen babies in Bethlehem? Yes, that's all there were. Please understand that the atrocity in Bethlehem was even less than Connecticut in terms of the number of babies that were killed. We get the wrong idea, you know, the Hollywood-y versions where Herod's troops span across the sleeping town and they find babies both sides of the street, all stories of the apartments, and kill them. No, a little Bethlehem was not that big. I did an actuarial study of Bethlehem. There'd be about two dozen babies, 2 years old and under, half of them the wrong sex. And so this is the kind of information, amid so much infant mortality in the ancient world, that wouldn't even have come, I think, to the ears of Josephus. And that's, I think, the reason he didn't record it.
Then, finally, with the last few minutes that are left to us, Dr. Meyer, had we been among those shepherds who are startled out of their nighttime shepherd duties by the announcement of the angels and go to Bethlehem, he says they go with haste to Bethlehem to see the thing they'd been told, what would we have seen had we entered that place where Christ had just been born? Paint a picture for us.
Well, I think, first of all, we would not have seen any kind of a halo over the baby or over the Blessed Virgin or Joseph. That's what we would expect usually, or the immediate adoration. It would have been a perfectly natural scene. And I think the only thing that could have brought the shepherds to an otherwise natural birth taking place under unnatural circumstances was, of course, the angelic appearance ahead of time. You know, when the heavens open up with the chorus of angels singing, that's pretty impressive. And I think at that point they're going to follow the heavenly orders in order to come to Bethlehem. So they're primed with that. For that reason, the ordinary becomes extraordinary as far as they're concerned. And I like the reaction of the shepherds. You know, they did exactly what Christians are supposed to do. when they had seen it, they made known abroad the saying which is told them concerning this child. And the shepherds returned, glorifying and praising God for all things they had heard and seen. What a wonderful reaction to the Nativity account. They told what they saw, and that's exactly what Christians should do to the present day. What we see in faith, we ought to tell others about.
How would they have, I mean, they knew what the sign would be, but how would these shepherds, obviously familiar with Bethlehem as a town, how would they have found one baby, even in a small town?
It wasn't the star, I should say, shining over the stable. It wasn't anything like that. Bethlehem is really pretty small, let's remember. And so when you have a very pregnant woman who can't find a place to have her baby, this becomes the big town gossip for sure. And so when they come into Bethlehem, there's no question that the word of mouth had passed, and I think they'd have no trouble finding the main caravansary or inn where this took place.
And so we can take our creche, keep our creche, but perhaps turn it into a grotto. We can have Mary and Joseph. We can have the baby, maybe a few animals in there, and the shepherds, and be content with that. Is that what you're saying, Dr. Meyer?
That's fine, but there's no reason you can't have a few magi in the background. I mean, there's no reason to overthrow the traditional view. It's that we're not going to say that these crushes are absolutely, totally faithful to the facts of history. You can coalesce them a little bit. We do coalesce things regularly.
Well, finally, with only about a minute here, what does it mean for you as an historian to again and again look at this story that's recorded so well and so consistently by the gospel writers? What sense do you have of that as not only as a Christian theologian, but as an historian?
Well, of course, it is totally extraordinary. I mean, out of the ordinary. I mean, this is unlike anything you ever find from the ancient world, no question about that. And for that reason, you know, I was always very concerned about these exceptions, you know. This is not the rule, you know. You don't have heavens open up with not just stars, but angels singing and this kind of thing. And for that reason, I went into ancient history, and it's been my bag ever since, to try to find points of tangency between the sacred account and the secular evidence on the outside. And so I've had just a lot of fun comparing sacred and secular over three or four decades here. And I find that again and again, the biblical record lines up very, very well with the parameters of evidence that we have from all over the ancient world, the geographical factors, the archaeological factors, the historical data is borne out very, very well indeed by the Nativity account. And so these exceptional things happen in a very, very historical background.
Dr. Paul Meyer is Professor Emeritus of Ancient History at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. He's author of several books, including In the Fullness of Time, A Historian Looks at Christmas, Easter, and the Early Church, and his latest novel titled The Constantine Codex. Dr. Meyer, thanks for being our guest, and Merry Christmas.
Thank you, Todd. Blessed Christmas to you, too.
In the next hour of Issues, Etc. on this Christmas Day, we're going to study a Christmas hymn, Hark the Herald Angels Sing. Dr. Arthur Just will be our guest. Folks, if you appreciate our special Christmas programming, please consider making a special Christmas gift to support the worldwide outreach of Issues, Etc. You can make your financial contribution by check. Make your check payable to Issues, Etc. Send it to Issues, Etc., Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Here's that address again. Issues, Etc., Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also make a year-end tax-deductible donation at our website, issuesetc.org. Now remember, for any sized year-end gift, we will send you a CD of Lutheran Service Book, Hymns and Services, and a CD with the sermon that I've preached on the birth of Christ and on the Confession of St. Peter. Thanks for listening, and thanks for keeping us in mind during this Christmas season. The picture as it is painted by the gospel writers is one of remarkable ordinariness. Ordinary people, Mary and Joseph, behaving in ordinary ways, and remarkable extraordinariness. That is, this child born of these ordinary people, the Son of God, Son of Mary, makes this story something completely different. Not just the birth of a baby story, but a changing of human history story, the entrance of salvation through his death and resurrection into our world story. I'm Todd Wilkin. More Issues Etc. after this break.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Here's a special offer for Issues Etc. listeners. For any size year-end gift, we'll send you a CD of sermons preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin on Christmas and on the conversion of Paul. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. You can also contribute by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. And for any size year-end gift, we'll send you a CD of one of Todd's Christmas and conversion of Paul sermons.
The grace of God, the church's music, the Lord's Supper, every service, every Sunday, and Wednesdays too, preaching Christ crucified and risen. There is hope in St. Louis, Hope Lutheran Church, that is, 5218 Neosho Street, St. Louis, Missouri, or find us on the web at hopelutheranstl.org.
Hey, St. Louis. How would you like to achieve your fitness goals in a fun and supportive atmosphere? Hi, this is Kevin Reisick, owner and operator of Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois. We offer adult boot camps throughout the week. These camps include cardiovascular conditioning, muscular strength and endurance training, balance and coordination activities, and more. For more information, give me a call at 618-670-6952, Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois, 618-670-6952.
Issues Etc. regular guests, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, Dr. Stephen Hine, Dr. Angus Manouge, and Craig Parton will be speaking at the summer study sessions of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, July 8th through the 19th in Strasbourg, France. For more information, visit apologeticsacademy.eu. The International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, July 8th through the 19th, apologeticsacademy.eu.